Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Legal Geeks covering Star Trek Lower Decks. This one, I believe, episode 9, penultimate of the season. Joining me today is a founding member of the Legal Geeks and attorney at law, Joshua Gilliland, and Dana Nicholas, also attorney at law. So let's just kick it off. Dana, how's your week going? How did you like this episode?
I love this episode. It was absolutely hilarious and chock full of references to old Star Trek episodes and characters, and so it was a lot of fun.
How about you, Josh?
I'm recovering from a cold, so let's just say that I'm glad you're here as always. and this episode was a ton of fun. The cameo at the end was very heartfelt and just full of homages from within Lower Decks itself across all of Trek as well. From my first job was at a movie theater. And I always enjoy seeing when they do the movie episode that you can see the film imperfections and the real changes, which is the little mark in the upper right-hand corner every few minutes. All of that just shows the true labor of love that they've done to filmmaking.
So let's go ahead and dive right in. So we're going to be going a little bit not in sort of chronological order with this episode. I assume the listeners will bear with us. There were a few less legal issues. Some of the Lower Decks episodes this season have just been absolute gift wrapped smorgasbords for geeky lawyers trying to spot legal issues. This one, they took a tiny bit of a break, and so we only have sort of a handful of things to talk about. But the first thing that sort of came to mind for me, at least, and then there's a few more interesting juicy bits that we can cover, was actually came to me closer to the end. During the course of the episode, it is revealed that Boimler's transporter clone, William Boimler, has died in what is evidently a freak accident, some sort of neurosine gas or what have you, had leaked into his quarters and only his quarters, which is sort of some of the premise for the fundamental episode and the adventures that their heroes get on to sort of cope with that. But it comes back at the end in very interesting fashion, in which William Boimler, the transporter clone, wakes up apparently having faked his death in order to join Section 31. I know some of you guys spotted some other things earlier, but I'll just talk about this one, even though it's at the end of the episode, for just a sec. Because it did get me thinking, it seems wrong to fake one's death. It almost certainly is going to result in a lot of broken relationships if it ever comes out. But is it illegal? And that was an interesting question to ponder. And the answer that I came to, although I will admit I am not a fake death expert, I have not represented someone who has tried to do so, is that essentially there isn't really a specific crime associated with faking one's death. So the act in and of itself probably doesn't carry liability. The issue is, though, that when one fakes one's death, typically there are subsequent acts involved that probably do constitute crimes. So any benefits that somebody tries to get as a result of their death, death insurance, things like that, or sorry, I should call it life insurance is the technically correct word. Trying to collect on any of those benefits or allow those benefits to accrue to others could constitute fraud. Would be an obvious one. But also the, perhaps more benign and common thing that comes into story making is when someone fakes their death in order to, kind of what William Boimler is doing here, start a new life under a new identity. And the answer to that is, you know, setting aside the Section 31 stuff, which we can come back to, you know, just the act of creating a new identity, filling out any forms under that new identity, you know, new, if you get a new job, you have to fill out identification paperwork, getting an apartment, you have to fill out identification paperwork, using a false identity for that, all of that would also constitute at minimum fraud, potentially depending on what forms you're lying on, could also constitute other crimes. And so in general, if you continue to do anything other than live on your own in a cabin out in the wilderness after faking your death, you are probably committing various crimes. And then also, oh, sorry, go ahead, Dana.
Oh, I was just going to say, once someone has faked their death or assumed a new identity, what do you, there might be some legal action on what do you do to assume a new identity? How do you get a new name? And so can you just get a new name or new identity by using it? Or do you have to file documents in court? And I think that the different jurisdictions have different views on that. In some jurisdictions, you can assume a new identity just by continuing to use it. And others, you have to go through a complete legal process.
I'll add, he's now gone AWOL.
Well, it, yeah, if it comes out that he is in fact alive, yes, yeah, he has left his post.
Yeah, he's gone AWOL by faking his own death.
Although he would argue he's been reassigned.
Right, with Section 31.
Yeah, a couple of other podcasts have theorized the female voice that was Giorgio from Discovery. If that she landed back in time at this point. And so if we do see a live action Section 31 show, it would be with her in this time period. And does that mean we get William Boimler?
In live action? I mean, he does have a real actor who is on some other pretty good shows. So,
I mean, I don't think Jack Quaid would say no to the work. We are going to see him in live action when they do the crossover with Strange New Worlds. So I'm not sure when that's going to happen, if it's next season or if it's during Strange New Worlds' second season, how that will play out, or if it's, well, regardless, the future will present itself. But that said, yeah, faking one's death, it is an affirmative act of fraud, and there are repercussions when it comes to people who've been paid death benefits and then they find out the person's alive.
Yeah, and there's also, I think, we won't rehash it too much, Josh, but I know that the Legal Geeks covered, for example, after the big snap in the Marvel universe, there are all kinds of legal ramifications to death besides apparently getting out of one's posting in Starfleet, including, you know, property that issues per wills or per intestate succession and things like that. So there are very complicated things that happen whether or not William Boimler here intends it.
And did they leave a clone corpse body so that way there's something to bury, or did they just shoot him out on the photon torpedo and the Defiant class vessel picked up the photon torpedo as part of the big con? We don't know, but it was a nice fun way to end it with a redacted section of space.
And before we get too far off the topic, sorry, Dana, did you have another thought before I move on to sort of a quick legal comment about Section 31 generally?
I just was thinking, as like an errant ADA, my ADD brain, you know what, they keep shooting all of these caskets out into space. You know, it's at some point there's going to be hazards, and have they created a hazard legally by shooting these caskets out in space? Somebody's going to crash into them.
You know, I think that is interesting. There surely need to be better regulations about the disposal of sentient remains in space. You're right that for a while, space is so big and empty, it can't possibly be an issue. But at some point, after who knows how many hundreds of years of spacefaring for how many billions of people, yeah, that's a good question.
It stems back to the tradition of burying people at sea. whether it was you sew up the corpse in a sail with two cannonballs, that way it sinks, or other variations on that that have continued in the present day. But the ocean is alive. Not that it's sentient, but it's full of life. And the corpse sinks to the bottom, and the remains are disposed of through nature. Space is a vacuum, and while we have seen space breathing life forms, the idea that there's no decomposition, so the corpse remains a corpse for a very, very long time until it, I don't know, gets sucked into the gravity of a star. It's not like you're shooting the torpedo out at the Genesis planet. It's something very different. And so good point, Dana. It's not like a burial at sea. Which brings us to some other options that can happen. That just thinking back to the beginning of Crisis Point 2, with the Romulan triplets attacking the Cerritos, perhaps the Cerritos A, that's never really clear. Are they acting under orders of the Empire, or are they going rogue? Because if they are acting under orders of the Empire, that's definitely an act of war. And you go attack another Federation starship, and thus you've started a war. But that was also a nice little homage to the Duras sisters, and seeing these Romulan triplets being evil and behaving in their special triplet language. So it does raise an interesting command and control structure when you have three commanders. I guess the only way it could work is if they were triplets. So.
Before we get too off the topic, I did want to just give a quick general thought about Section 31, especially if, as you said, Josh, there may or may not be a standalone Section 31 show, which is just that, you know, I'm sure I am not alone among Trek fans and being a little bit troubled by Section 31. And one of the things that's worth noting is that, you know, we do have real life covert law enforcement activities. You know, not every law enforcement activity is out in broad daylight. Not all of them are knocking and announce when they come to search a house. There are wiretaps, there are secret surveillance and things like that. However, as with any law enforcement activity, what makes it lawful is process. Process and oversight and accountability. And in order to set up a secret wiretap, in order to secretly gain entrance to a building and set up surveillance cameras, law enforcement still has to get a warrant. They still have to get judicial authorization to undertake what would be otherwise illegal invasion of privacy and other things like that. Simply because somebody wears a uniform, has a badge, doesn't mean that the laws that apply to the rest of us don't apply to them. It only doesn't apply if they follow process and the correct procedures are followed. And so this is an issue, of course, if you have a secret organization like Section 31, in which there, you know, by its very nature, there is no accountability, there is no oversight. There's no higher organization that they answer to. There's no, as far as we know, there's no even equivalent of, like, in the US, we have the FISA court, which is essentially a secret court that would oversee and issue wiretap warrants. Even though those things didn't make it out into the public, you still had, if anyone isn't familiar, you essentially had judges who would essentially take turns secretly serving on this court to review requests for warrants and those kinds of things. Now, I want to caveat that we, of course, post-Snowden know that there were serious issues with the FISA process, but there was still a process. Here, we don't have even a flawed process to oversee Section 31 because they exist totally separate from Starfleet, from the Federation. The Federation denies that they even exist. They did for a while. Sorry, go ahead.
Yes. Well, thinking back to Deep Space Nine, when we're introduced to Luther Sloan, and the arc that they have with trying to recruit Bashir. Sisko asks for confirmation of it, and they don't confirm, but they don't deny.
Thank you for correcting me. Yes.
Yeah, it's not a correction. It's 20 years in the past. Like, remembering the details is difficult. So no, it's not a correction.
But you agree with me, Josh, that even though they neither confirm nor deny the existence, they definitely don't have a Federation court set up to review their requests for warrants.
No, and the fact that it raises the very interesting question on how to maintain peace. You know, Marvel Comics did a series called Original Sin that focused on Nick Fury being the man on the wall for, you know, 5 decades, where he would take out threats before they became a threat. And then they had Bucky Barnes take over that role after Fury is sentenced to the moon. All a great story. And it's a complex thing to think about, because it's not preventative war. It's preventative assassinations and black ops, things that make us all uncomfortable to go, is that's what's being done in the darkness to maintain peace. And in the Federation, Discovery touched on the Section 31 with more fanfare than I thought warranted a secret organization. But again, a century's passed, so it makes sense that people wouldn't know about it anymore. But again, there's a lot to think about. I mean, Enterprise touched on it with Malcolm Reed being recruited into it. So it's appeared in different forms. And, but yeah, it's no oversight, no judicial process. They have their own black ops budget, and they're just bumping people off. Pretty terrifying and not compatible with a free society.
Totally. I think, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. And what about the process of them being in Starfleet itself? Maybe this is a workplace condition that they've signed off on, right? So we've got Section 31. Maybe it's akin to like the Postal Secret Service or some other group that helps to monitor and maintain the integrity of the institution that's already in place. So maybe they've already consented to being wiretapped. Often in places of employment, they let you know that you have no expectation of privacy while you're there. So that's an interesting topic to look into as well.
Yeah, maybe Section 31 can morph into, because, you know, it's compatible with a free society, can be transformed into essentially an Inspector General's office, just policing Starfleet.
But Starfleet is so broad that, you know, it could be anywhere. They do so much. They could be anywhere and do pretty much anything.
Well, it's, again, Deep Space Nine reference again with Temporal Affairs showing up after the Tribbles celebration anniversary episode they did, which were kind of the internal affairs for folks who engage in time travel. So it's not unprecedented. And it makes sense that you would want some form of oversight. The secret assassination, not so much.
There is that matter of killing people. I don't think that you can waive your right to life or employment.
Yeah. But
I doubt that he as well. And also could be an unconstitutional condition if this counts as the federal government.
Which, speaking of death, let's highlight bereavement leave, because that's a thing. And California, we have a new law in California giving folks bereavement leave. The new law is AB 1949, and you get 5 days of leave after the death of a family member. Does not need to be consecutive. For Boimler, the fact that it's his transporter clone Quinn that died, well, that's just a little weird. I mean, technically, yeah, he is your twin now. You didn't start life with a twin, but you ended up getting one. And from a psychology perspective, how did he turn so differently? Was it the lack of the friends? Was it just feeding into ambition? Riker's trombone and smooth jazz lessons? Like, what drove someone to go that evil?
Hey, don't blame the jazz. Don't blame the jazz, Josh. But what it does is bring up is a very interesting issue of who constitutes your family. What is family? And so I'd be interested in your thoughts on how that would apply.
Star Trek is about found family. Nimoy decided to make Star Trek 3 and 4 about found family, and which highlights, you know, in 3, you know, you have Kirk and everyone willing to sacrifice their careers on, oh, we gotta go save the Doctor. And Spock's soul, I'm willing to do prison time for that. That's a pretty big commitment and an act of love for one dead guy and one guy that you don't want to die. And then 4 is just you and everyone that you love on an adventure together. So it's Star Trek is definitely about that. And it's probably why it's it has heart. And when the series doesn't have that, it's not as successful.
So Dana, I think you bring up an interesting point, which is also what the legal definition of family is. That does, my understanding is at least it does vary somewhat from statute to statute. Statutes typically, if they say family, but I'm assuming not always, will define what's encompassed, and it can be broader or narrower. You know, this is one of the things, though, that, for example, has been one of the subjects of the fight over, for example, expanding recognition of and access to legal marriage. So, because typically statutes, including a lot of benefit statutes, and in this case, for example, it might be even California's bereavement statute, will be limited to family members, and that typically includes spouses. And then that can be somewhat tricky because states are the ones that issue marriage licenses, and at least for a significant period of time in the United States, there were really big differences between what states, which couples states would issue marriage licenses to, which there's been conflict about states recognizing marriages that have been formed in other states. And so this is where, you know, sort of the rubber hits the road when it comes to marriage equality. It is often in these definitions of family and all of the legal consequences and benefits that can flow from that. So that's a really good point I think you bring up. You really have to look sort of statute by statute to see whether or not a clone would be, I'm going to assume in most US laws, a clone would not be included, but who knows?
Well, this hasn't happened before. We'll just wing it, you know. I guess we'd rather give them a couple days off as opposed to not and then get sued later about it. So in the grand scheme of paperwork, letting them grieve for a day is an easier solution than not. But probably sending him to the psychiatrist to go, well, why don't you go visit him for a little bit? That also could be a healthy thing because it's much different than Picard finding out that his brother, sister-in-law, and nephew all die is crushing, and he takes a moment to go grieve and talk with Troy. That's still different than a clone of you dying. Which again is probably why Picard's like defeated and horrified at the end of Nemesis, where you know, his clone has impaled himself, and he's just unable to act out of pure shock.
And as litigators who work a lot of hours, when I die, I would like my 5 days of bereavement leave. Please don't call me with any new assignments.
I think that's reasonable. So. I think that's reasonable.
So there are a handful of other topics that I believe some of you guys have added that we could talk about. Would one of you guys like to start off on one of the topics maybe that you've added here?
Yeah, here's a quick one, and it's the, you know, again with Sulu, who's managing Kirk's ranch in Idaho.
I loved that line, by the way. Is this heaven? No, it's Idaho.
Man could never rest. And we have, you know, Sulu warn about, you know, it's okay, we want to feed the horsey. And then it turns to, the horsey will bite you now. So there's a warning. But it raises the issue of an animal bite. animal bites are, there's a bedrock of law with lawyers who practice. Have you or a loved one been bitten by a horse? Have you or a loved one been attacked by a great white shark? You can be entitled to compensation. And those obnoxious lawyer ads aside, there are precedents that we don't want people getting booed. So when it comes to a horse bite, a horse is a domestic animal. Yeah, you can have a wild horse, but horses are in the domestic animal category. So, which turns it into an issue of negligence, as opposed to strict liability. If it were a wild animal, like, you can't have a pet bear. Sure, there are people who do, but any injuries the bear causes, they will be strictly liable for. Or again, here's my pet alligator, you know, that I allow to roam the backyard. You know, that's seems like a really, really
deep liability on four legs.
Yeah, Mr. Snappy, and with the teeth that never end. So in the case of the horse bite, let's talk about the restatement of torts, second, section 518. This section is applicable to domestic animals of a class that be confined to the premises of their keepers or otherwise under constant control. Now, if they're not under control, that's where the situation can change. It goes on to state, although the utility of these animals is sufficient to justify their being kept without the risk of strict liability stated in section 509, many of them are recognizably likely to do substantial harm while out of control, and thus their keepers under a duty to exercise reasonable care to have them under constant control and effective control. The horsey is under control. He's in the stable, it's been brushed, it's been fed. You have a very, very loving Captain Sulu taking care of you. I mean, it's everything a horse could want. And he then bites Boydler. To be fair, he was asking lots of questions. Should have kept one of, what was it like being the helmsman on the Enterprise? It just be that. You know, geez. Make it easy. But no, Boimler went fanboy.
And some jurisdictions apply the same principles, whether it is a domestic animal or a wild animal. So you could be liable for the bite of a dog in the same way, strictly liable, if you're in a state like perhaps California that applies strict liability.
Agreed. Which again, you have an animal, keep it on the leash or in its barn or stable. I mean, don't let the horse go free range in town. That's just weird.
Or have cats who never leave the house.
But then, you know, Boimler just wandered in off the street without an invitation. So if the horse is in this barn where he's supposed to be, you know, that raises some interesting issues about whether or not they would be responsible. But Sulu did advise him in advance, this horse is now going to bite you. So he was aware. So he probably would still be liable.
Yeah. All excellent points.
Absolutely.
So I think there's a few more topics here. Was it Dana or Josh? Would you like to get us started on them?
Those sure. are all Dana problems.
Sure. In workers' comp, it's really interesting at the end when they're all in the sick bay and the doctor says, you got to go. Our buddy's coming back in here. He's injured. And he comes in on the stretcher and he's like, oh, not for the second time today. He leaned against the warp core and was severely burned. And so that raises some interesting workers' compensation issues. You know, should the employer if it's a known hazard, have protected the staff from those known hazards? Like, should there be a barrier around a warp core? Not only could it burn someone, but, you know, can you imagine what would happen if the warp core actually burned an entire person? What would happen to the rest of those on the ship? So under workers' compensation in different jurisdictions, you may be able to sue your employer civilly if the employer intentionally causes the harm. But here we're not sure how much that would happen. And you may be able in some jurisdictions to collect extra benefits if the injury was caused by the employer's serious or willful misconduct. So I could imagine that in this scenario, not putting up a protective barrier around the warp core when you've previously been exposed to it could be a problem.
That was an excellent point. Excellent catch. I do have to wonder for the second time in a day. I think this person is an intelligent person. So I think you might be right, Dana. There might just be a failure of precautions. This might be like, you know, inside the Imperial Starship, there's no safety rails type issue. Although maybe the first one that we've heard in Star Trek as opposed to in Star Wars. And so I noticed also that you had a couple others in here. Did you have any thoughts on piracy or should we move straight to robbery? Because I did love that one.
Well, in piracy, stealing the origami, the chrono origami,
chronogami, on the ship,
chrono origami. It's too hard. You know, I want to put a personal shout out to the writers of the show. If you could please, for the love of all that Star Trek, make some things that I can pronounce that for me. That would be a personal favor. Love you forever. But if you're entering another vessel for the purpose of taking something from another with the intent to permanently deprive, there you have some piracy issues.
That's an excellent point. I want to build off that just a little bit, touching on something that I think Josh talked about earlier, which is it's not really made clear in this Crisis Point 2 movie or Holovid whether or not the Romulans here are acting under direction of the Romulan government or whether they're sort of this rogue group that has a Romulan ship. And that actually is one of the big distinctions between piracy and what would otherwise be within the law of war, a lawful attack on a vessel, which, you know, for, you know, unfortunately happens frequently in military history. There's at least one particularly, I will say, comic incident involving, so in the Civil War, this was early enough in technology that it would take a long time to disseminate information, sometimes weeks, sometimes months. And the Confederacy had a number of vessels at sea whose job it was to just prey upon Union merchant vessels. It's very common in warfare. The Germans did it a lot in World War I and II, et cetera. But so the Confederacy had a few ships that were out at sea preying on fishing vessels and merchant vessels, just doing whatever they could to sort of cause havoc for any Union states. And it took months for word to get to some of them that the war was over. In that span of time, they had committed a number of these attacks. When the two groups were now at peace, the war was over, the Confederacy had surrendered, which meant technically they were all acts of piracy. In at least one case, I'm forgetting the name of the ship, but it's a very famous incident. Oh, do you have it, Josh?
The book is Last Flag Down, and it's the CSS Savannah, which after they captured some whaling ships off Alaska, mm-hmm. is when they found out, oh crap, like that. I mean, they were already on the wrong side of history anyway. And the book is brilliant, even though it's written by the descendant of the first officer who was a little too in love with great, great, great grandpa. So like that stuff is a tad annoying where it's like, you know, your ancestor was fought to preserve slavery. Why are you being so romantic about it? But the spy craft that took place, because those ships were built in England, and the ambassador to the United Kingdom was Charles Francis Adams. So, you know, grandson and son of US presidents. And so he was also in charge of the spy ring to go out and fight them and stop them. So like they would get arms at sea. The ship had a retractable propeller. So it was at this age where you had, you know, sails and propellers. And so they thought that if the prop became disengaged and then raised up into the hull, that would reduce drag for when they were under sail. But it's a fascinating story. And when they surrendered to the Brits.
I was going to say that's a very key part here. Knowing that they would be tried as pirates in the United States, they fled to the UK.
Yeah, so where they thought they would not just be executed on the spot. So, yeah, nice little, because England wanted to play both sides up until the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, because when it officially became a war to end slavery, the Brits couldn't support the South anymore. Savannah. The book's in a box. It's going back up on the bookshelf, but it's an excellent read and a fascinating history of people doing some, the seamanship is interesting. And then the oh crap moment, realizing, what do you mean the war is over? Because it's, you know, there were no telegrams going out to them.
Yes, an excellent encapsulation. But yes, I think, Dana, you're absolutely right to, Internet, sorry. Okay, you're absolutely right to point this out. It matters significantly whether or not under the auspices of the Romulan government military here as to whether or not they are pirates or whether or not this is an act of war. Neither is great, but in one instance, at least they have a sort of, you know, prisoner of war and other rules that would apply to them in these instances. To get to your next topic that you added, which I really loved, which was the topic of robbing your would-be assailants. I thought that was great.
Yeah, I mean, just because someone attempts to rob you does not mean that you can then thusly rob them. Like, it's not an eye for an eye situation. And so in this episode, we see that the assailants, even though they are hollow characters, they probably did still have some rights. So they attempted to rob Tendi and her friends. And then attempts to rob them by taking their clothes. And it was hilarious when he says, "Oh, come on, let me at least get the pants." Really? You have to get the pants? And he's like, we have to have larger assailants because the pants were too small.
Yeah. We gotta go find some more punks. That was really great. A great point here to make. It also, I will just say, the scene involved, I think, my favorite line from this particular episode, which was Jack saying, "Oh, stop, please, we don't want any witnesses." That was great.
That absolutely was great.
Absolutely correct. In law, at least, two wrongs don't make a right. You don't get to wrong the person who has just wronged you.
And it's very different than words. So if someone defames you, you're allowed to defame them equally, right? But in this case, if somebody attempts to rob you, you are not allowed to rob them equally. That just doesn't match up.
Absolutely. And in case anyone is curious also, this is not necessarily a commentary on self-defense. Like, you're allowed to defend yourself when someone is trying to rob you. But we're talking about Rutherford trying to pull the pants off one of the guys afterwards. That is not encompassed within the right to self-defense.
And you would think that if it's a holodeck program and it's written into the program, that they would have made the hollow pants fit him, right? Like, that's just an issue of body shaming.
That's great.
So like, why are they making him so much larger? And I think that kind of goes into our next issue, which is kind of bias and DEI. So with diversity, equity, inclusion, it can include a lot of things. It's not just the typical things that we think of, like, you know, the difference in gender or the difference in race or ability, but it can also include people's weight. And here they make it so that he's like, you know, you're not thin enough to fit in the pants. And he's not necessarily a large character, but that's something that people should be aware of. And then under ABA Model Rule 8.4, any lawyers who, it's misconduct for a lawyer if they violate the rules of professional conduct by allowing harassment or discrimination on the race, on the basis of race, sex, religion, national origin, ethnicity, disability, age, sexual orientation, gender identity, marital status, or socioeconomic status. Whew, that's a mouthful. Or, you know, any other basis that can cause the lawyer to proceed or to, can cause people to believe that the lawyer is not following through with his ability to be impartial and to represent the law well. Okay, so that discrimination, it also includes harmful verbal or physical contact that manifests in bias or prejudice towards others. So it can include sexual harassment, derogatory or demeaning verbal contact, physical conduct. It can include unwelcome sexual advances, requests for sexual favors, unwelcome verbal or physical conduct of a sexual nature. So there's a lot that gets wrapped up into that. And this rule was recently changed in 2016. So that's a newish rule that people have different varying political beliefs on. But that's just there. And so when we look at that rule, in the earlier scenes, one of the Hollow characters, she's the doctor, and they make the comment, you know, he's like, this isn't about sex. This isn't about romance. And they say, well, then why did you make her so hot? You know, they're making that comment on a female's physical appearance, but they don't make that comment about any of the men's physical appearance. And so that makes it very difficult. I would also point out that it taught when they're disregarding Tendi as captain, right? She's the acting captain and she's very excited. And Rutherford is like, nah, she's not going to pay attention to it. He's eating a sandwich. And he goes, you got to have chips. So he's eating the chips after she said, okay, everybody be very quiet. And it's just a blatant disregard for her leadership or her authority. And that would be a violation of the rule if you were a lawyer. And it's unclear from the model rule whether or not that would apply if he was just in a courtroom or if it's in any legal setting or any setting at all, because that could cause a problem.
Well, so I guess I have to eat my words here. I thought we would have a hard time doing a full episode of Legal Geeks based on this episode of Lower Decks, but it looks like we, unsurprisingly, the three of us have had plenty to talk about and plenty to have fun with.
Three lawyers can talk, even if one of them's only at half capacity.
go ahead, Josh.
I want to make a quick correction. It wasn't the CSS... Savannah, was the CSS Shenandoah. I checked Google and just to make sure, because it's been about a decade since I read that book, and I believe there was a Savannah as well, but the story is about the Shenandoah. So the book Last Flag Down, highly recommended, and the audiobook is free off Amazon. And the author is Michael Kramer.
But so with that...
Narrator's Michael Kramer. Authors were John Baldwin and Ron Powers.
With that, do we want to maybe just take a minute to each of us talk about sort of the things that we loved about this episode that we haven't had a chance to talk about in our legal analysis so far? Dana, do you want to maybe start us off?
I love that Nick Knack exploded. He did the Yoda move, right? So he's this small little creature and you're like, oh, he's so cute and adorable. And then he throws off his cloak and he's like, rah, I'm the big guy and I can kick butt. And so I absolutely positively love that. And then at the end, when she's like, you know, this isn't, I she had disavowed the franchise and thought, no, this isn't, it's not worthy of me. And then she goes, you know, after second thought, upon reflection, this is really good. And so that to me was really just kind of an awesome feed.
All right. What about you, Josh?
We referenced the koala in the holodeck. So the ship seems to be aware of those who have referenced the koala to build it into an active story. I enjoyed hearing Ransom, you know, giving an evaluation to Mariner. And he references, you know, being able to talk to his buddies when he's not doing well, and includes Matt the Whale. And there's a nice, you know, they see a picture of like him and his buddies all hanging out. And naturally the whale's there in a big, big tank. So very, very cute to work in the whales.
For me, I'll just add that I think I've told you, Josh, that I Dungeon Master a couple campaigns of Dungeons and Dragons, and the dynamic between Tendi and Rutherford while playing this Holovid was just such a perfect encapsulation of what you actually sometimes really see when you're playing a role-playing game with friends, is that people have very different things they're trying to get out of it, and some people just want to be able to sort of make fun of the names and joke and laugh about it and eat chips. Oh, this is also my kitten. and some people want to take it really seriously. And Tendi really was obviously taking it very seriously as a chance for her to essentially practice being captain, which she really wanted to do. I've seen similar things happen in real life as well. And so it was pretty funny extra funny for me as a DM to be watching that. Before we close out, I did want to give a shout out to our first Patreon, Astro Kangaroo. Thank you very much for your support. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Josh, you will get access to a little bit of exclusive content through Patreon. Hopefully you'll keep tuning into us in the future for all of our future podcasts and shows.
Yes, big thank you. And there is some extra content there. And we'll be adding more. So, but there's some behind the scenes where with the practices for the Poe Dameron court martial, so the witness prep, and some other analysis from different posts that weren't public about Crisis on Infinite Earths and some other fun stuff.
All right. I think with that brings us to the end of this episode of The Legal Geeks Lower Decks. Thank you everybody for listening. We'll see you next week for the season finale, which I know we're all very excited for. Until then, what do you usually say? Stay geeky and live long and prosper.